The Fed chairman makes the case for more action.
But there is only so much he and the Fed can do.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's October 15th. Why Bernanke doesn't hold all the cards. Why Tim Geithner wants to make sure China doesn't hold too many cards. And all the business news for one last time in a Marketplace Minute. But first,
let us welcome our Friday regular. Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial joins us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with this morning's news on the economy. How good was the retail sales report?
It was actually really good. Retail sales were not only better than expected in September, they were revised up in August. And I think it's important to remember that a month ago when the August numbers came, economists, myself included, thought they were decent mostly because discounting pulled sales from September. So the fact we kept the momentum going, that's a really good thing.
Very good. And the other big news this morning was inflation. What's the story there?
Well, I think the biggest story is that we're looking at consumer price inflation today. It's only up 1% in the last year. We got wholesale price inflation yesterday, and it was up 4% in the last year. What that tells you is that, the commodity prices are rising. Costs are increasing for businesses. It's one more reason that businesses are reluctant to hire. And ironically enough, the Fed bears some responsibility for that. All this talk about further accommodation has driven the dollar down, and that's what's pushing commodity prices up.
All right. Commodities, oil, makes that more expensive. Well, this leads us right to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, who has seen the inflation data this morning. He spoke in Boston, and reporter Janet Babin tells us that he did make the case for more stimulus, Fed style.
Like most of the country, Fed Chairman Bernanke's worried about the high unemployment rate. He says it poses a risk to economic recovery. The Fed chairman's also concerned about inflation being too low. And he says the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, is ready to act to deal with low inflation.
The Federal Reserve remains committed to pursuing policies that promote our dual objectives of maximum employment and price stability. In particular, the FOMC is prepared to provide additional accommodation if needed to support the economic recovery and to return inflation over time to levels consistent with our mandate.
This means the Fed's considering whether to buy more treasuries as a way to bring market interest rates lower. But the Fed is still weighing how aggressively to pursue these monetary policies. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Okay, and back with economist Chris Lowe. Chris, as you heard, they're still not a definite considering, prepared. With unemployment so stubborn, it's easy to say, well, go, Ben, go, stimulate. But what is the risk of the Fed doing all this possible asset buying?
Well, I think the biggest risk is this, that policymakers, by their very nature, are supposed to come up with solutions when the economy is in trouble. That's why the Fed is talking about quantitative easing, which would be purchasing more assets to drive interest rates down. The risk is that it may not be enough to have a material impact on aggregate demand. In other words, economy might not pick up very much, but it could have a very big increase on the dollar. We've already seen the dollar weaken quite a bit. That's pushing commodity prices up, as I said earlier. And among other things, what that does is it means that when consumers are driving to the mall, they have to stop and get gas on the way. They're going to see those prices going up. And in fact, it may induce them to put their wallets away rather than pulling them out.
Harder to stimulate activity than it sounds. Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner has been warning it's time to get tough with China over its undervalued currency. Well, today could be the day. The Treasury is due to release a report on currency manipulators. Marketplace's John Dimsdale says China might make the list for the first time.
If Treasury finds China is artificially keeping its export prices low, the administration is required to start consultations to fix the imbalance. Dan Rosen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics wonders, what's the big deal?
The Treasury Department is already consulting with the Chinese intensely. So in part, this would be a little bit of theater where we were upping the rhetorical position of the U.S. on the issue.
Congress is trying to wave a bigger stick. The House last month overwhelmingly approved hefty retaliatory tariffs on just about all Chinese imports. And Scott Paul with the Alliance for American Manufacturing wants the Senate to pass the bill before the year is out.
We need every tool in the toolbox to get China to change this job-killing behavior.
One other possibility would be enlisting international support against China. The U.S. tried that at this month's International Monetary Fund annual meetings without much success. But analysts say China's cheap currency also hurts exports from Europe, Japan, and even developing countries like Brazil. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
While a lot of people wait for jobs, entrepreneurs are making their own by launching startup companies, developing new software, more efficient batteries, life-saving drugs. But investment in startups fell off during the recession, and it's taking a while to come back. From the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
The National Venture Capital Association reports this morning that investment was down 30% from the second quarter to the third. That's partly because VCs go on vacation in August, so they don't do as many deals. And investment's actually up substantially compared to the depths of the recession.
We were quite upbeat.
Michael Greeley is with Flybridge Capital Partners in Boston.
The pace of innovation continues kind of unabated. You know, we saw in our portfolios consistently 50 to 100% revenue growth.
And Greeley says money's now pouring into companies that are just starting out, with an idea and technology in development, but often no sales or customers yet.
The amount of first-time financings is a great barometer for the health of the industry. You know, that really is probably the most risky investment that venture capitalists are asked to make.
The fledgling startups being favored most for investment right now are in biotechnology, software, and new media. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Today there's a meeting regarding the government's fraud and insider trading case against three former Countrywide execs. Countrywide Financial played a big role in the subprime mortgage mess. And today's powwow is one of the only enforcement actions the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, has taken against the mortgage crisis. Edward Wyatt is a reporter covering the story for The New York Times. He's with us now live from New York. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
What's the meeting about?
Well, the meeting is officially called a status conference, but it appears that they are working on a settlement of the case, which is scheduled to go to trial next Tuesday. It looks like it might be settled today.
All right. So what could the settlement be then, Edward?
Well, typically in these cases, the SEC has asked for substantial fines to be paid. Usually with these settlements, the defendants neither admit nor deny the charges, but then they also agree never to do them again.
What are they charged with?
Well, they're charged with two things. The biggest charge is disclosure fraud, simply that the Countrywide executives did not they weren't honest with investors about the fact that they were widening their standards for mortgages in 2004 through 2007, that they were underwriting riskier and riskier mortgages. There also is an insider trading charge against Anthony Mazzillo, the founder and CEO of Countrywide, saying that he sold over about $140 million worth of stock while he knew that this information was not being disclosed.
All right. Edward Wyatt from The New York Times. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Listening to the Midday Update for Friday, October 15th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. It's the first time in more than 3.5 decades, 36 years to be exact, that an Iranian will lead the oil cartel OPEC. But what does that mean for the rest of the world and the oil coming from OPEC? Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So does this mean OPEC's going militant?
Well, this sounds more worrying than it is. The presidency is largely a symbolic role. It doesn't really decide the cartel's tactics or strategy. That's determined by the majority of the group, and that is strongly influenced by the biggest producer, Saudi Arabia.
And OPEC just wrapped up its meeting in Vienna, Stephen. Are member nations happy with the current price? What is it, $80, $82 a barrel?
That's right. Well, you have on the one hand the militant minority, Iran, Libya, Algeria, Venezuela, all complaining about the fall in the value of the dollar. Oil is priced in dollars, so that's hit the purchasing power of their commodity. Those countries are calling for a price of $100 a barrel to compensate. But Julian Lee of the Center for Global Energy Studies says that's not the majority view.
The majority of OPEC recognizes that $80 a barrel in the current global economic environment, and probably in any economic environment, is an extremely good price for their commodity.
In fact, he says, given the fragility of the global economic recovery, $80 a barrel is probably too high a price.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is worried about expected cuts to Britain's defense budget. She says all NATO countries need to make appropriate contributions. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports from London.
A reduction in the defense budget is expected. Britain is one of the few NATO countries that spends 2% of its GDP on defense. But Secretary Clinton says defense cuts could send the wrong signal to other European allies.
NATO has been the most successful alliance for defensive purposes in the history of the world, I guess. But it has to be maintained. Now, each country has to be able to make its appropriate contributions.
But critics say defense budgets are poorly managed. Tim Banfield's with the National Audit Office, which monitors public spending.
The Minister of Defense's decision-making processes and budgeting processes are poor, so they're committing to more projects than they can afford.
Meantime, US Defense Secretary Robert Gates, en route to a NATO meeting in Brussels today, expressed worry that as US allies cut their defense spending, the more people will look to the US to cover whatever gaps are created. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, October 15th. I'm Bill Radke. If you want to know what's going on in the markets, it's an easy way to do it. Go to the numbers at marketplace.org. The Major League Baseball playoffs continue this weekend with games in Arlington, Texas, and Philadelphia. In Philly, the local businesses are hanging on every pitch. Reporter Joel Rose takes us there.
It's happy hour at the South Philly Bar and Grill, a TV-saturated sports bar a couple miles from the Phillies ballpark. Business is good for a weeknight, but co-owner Ken Brownell Sr. says it's nothing compared to what he'll do during a playoff game.
If they're winning, even during the course of a given game, people have a tendency to get more enthusiastic and buy an extra drink or buy extra food or whatever it might be. There's definitely an impact.
Brownell says his sales can jump 40% on a game night, but this is not the kind of impact you can plan for in advance. Co-owner Ken Brownell Jr. says you never really know how your team is going to do.
In the past, we've been burned by counting on the Eagles and other sports teams, and they just haven't come through, and the fans have given up. So I guess the Phillies kind of help balance it out for all the other sports teams that don't do so well.
The Phillies are trying to make it to the World Series for the third year in a row. That helped take the sting out of the recession for many local bars and restaurants. Peter Cherokee owns Chickies and Pete's, a local chain of sports-friendly restaurants.
Because I'm in Philadelphia and we have the Phillies making it to the World Series, our numbers are around the same. So we're like 1% up instead of being 20% down.
But not every business in town benefits from the team's success. Brian Dilworth is the booker for the Electric Factory, one of the top concert venues in Philadelphia.
People become baseball fans October 1st. They don't become necessarily Social Distortion fans October 1st.
Dilworth has learned the hard way that business drops 10% or more when the Phillies are playing. So he doesn't have anything on the calendar for Saturday or Sunday.
I'm not saying that I wouldn't do a Bob Dylan show or Bruce Springsteen show, but we didn't rush out to look for something, let's put it that way.
Still, Dilworth is rooting for the Phillies to make it back to the World Series. He just hopes they sweep through the playoffs quickly. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Most economic indicators provide a small snapshot of how the economy is doing. But in Colorado, one community wanted to go further. Marketplace's special correspondent David Brancaccio has a new beat, and it's called Economy 4.0. And today he looks at community indicators, a way to get a sense of what's working and what's not.
The first thing you need to know about Boulder County, Colorado, is that on average, it's rich. Household income is the 12th highest in the country. But a charity here wanted to go deeper.
It is much more diverse than people think.
Morgan Rogers at the Community Foundation of Boulder County calls herself a numbers geek. She combed through statistical data to create a numbers-based portrait of the area. Percentage of hybrid cars, 2%. Charitable giving, below the national average. And guess what? People in poverty, 11%. Then there are the public schools, where the performance of Latino students severely lagged the rest of the school population.
It surprised a lot of people. We have some kids who are showing up in first grade who can read, who know their numbers, and we have other kids that are showing up who have barely held a crayon, and they're all in the same classroom together with one teacher.
Shamed into action by the alternative indicators, educators, parents, and politicians focused on the preschool years, where data show many Latino students get little formal education. Dennis Vigil is co-director of the nonprofit PASO, Providers Advancing School Outcomes. It's about helping the people who watch the preschoolers.
They are taken care of by their neighbor, the children are, or by a grandparent or an aunt or something like that, but they don't receive any educational support. They watch a lot of television, I'll say that much.
PASO expands the educational repertoire of caregivers through in-home visits and Saturday sessions like this one. Here, caregivers use a giant bingo game to help little ones match numbers. But PASO's program was running out of money. Spurred by the community indicators, the foundation was able to drum up support for its biggest ever grant, which in turn leveraged $630,000 more from the state. 600 preschoolers now have caregivers with the special training. The theory is that communities have to measure the right things to stand a chance of getting the outcomes they want. In Boulder, Colorado, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And finally, as for the business news in a Marketplace minute, I could talk about unemployment's rise or the dollar's demise or the deficit size or gold's new highs or the Nobel Prize or maybe Pfizer's consolidation with a corporation that makes pain medication, and there's always inflation. But I also must tell you I'm leaving this station. This is the final time for my rhyme. Going to relocate to my old home state so dozens of cousins can have a play date. Be as well as can be. Thanks for listening to me, and best wishes to Steve Chiotakis and to Marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
I'm going to miss you, man.
Thank you, Steve.
Good luck in Seattle. Absolutely. Have fun at Cairo Radio in Seattle, Washington.
Under the rain, I sure will.
You'll have a great time. I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.